Jesus can be a woman? Okay, come on up here, Sally. All right. And you'll need to study your lines. It says, Jesus, in parentheses, snores. Right there.
I remember what verse of the Bible I must have missed that one.
Oh, it's in the Greek, as I've said before. There you go. All right. So what I want to tell you before we hear this dramatic presentation of our passage from Mark is that I don't know of a single reputable scholar that would go to the mat to say that this is an historical episode in the life of Jesus. It's like the other miracle stories. It's a parable. It's a parable about the parable teller. And it's meant to make a point, not to make us go, "Ooh, look at the miracle that happened." It's, what does it mean? What is going on behind the action in this story? It's meant to make a point. Now, if you're someone hearing this for the first time as an ancient early Christian who's probably Jewish, it would not be missed on, you would not miss the fact that this sounds a lot like the story of Jonah. When Jonah heard the voice of God that said, you need to go straighten those Ninevites out, what did Jonah do? He went to Vegas, baby. He went as far away as he could get from Nineveh because he didn't want the job. And the very first thing he did was he went to sleep down in the hold of the ship. Okay, so there's some imagery here. Of course, Jesus doesn't get thrown off the boat like Jonah does in this story. But you'll recall that in other parts of the gospel that Jesus says, the only sign you're going to get is the sign of Jonah. And that's another sermon. But Jonah and Jesus have a lot of things going on together. And Mark takes advantage of it here. Maybe you're aware, if you've studied the classics, of a guy named Apollonius of Tyana. And he was a contemporary of Jesus. He lived during the same time period, and he's one of these people that for us has kind of been lost to history. But he was actually a very big figure during the first four centuries. In fact, in the marketing of early Christianity during the first four centuries, this guy was probably one of the number one competitors with Jesus because his followers were trying to further a religion based on this guy's teachings and on this guy's actions. And in the marketplace of religious ideas, it was kind of touch and go during the middle of the fourth century as to whether we were going to be Christians or Apollinarians, depending on who was going to win out. Apollonius was regarded as a master of storms, of fire, and perils of all kind, and he was known to still storms with just speaking a word. So there are a lot of similarities going on there. And then there are other things that are going on at the time. I mean, one of the things I've really enjoyed about what Nat's reading list has been Percy Jackson and the New Olympians. And have any of you seen any of those movies or anything like that? Unbelievable. But Nat can now go down the list and talk about, oh yeah, well, so-and-so is the daughter of so-and-so, and is the son of so-and-so, Zeus and Apollo and blah, 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 because he's read these stories and he knows the Greek myths. And it's really powerful to see visually in the movie Percy Jackson of Percy being able to command the water because his father is
Poseidon.
Exactly. So he has those gifts of being able to control water. And so in Jesus' day, anybody who was anybody was living in an environment where everybody knew that Poseidon was the god of water and could control the seas. And Zeus, too, was no slouch. And so when you hear a story like this in the first century, what you hear is Jesus going head to head with all of these other god figures. And the question is, who is going to win out? It helps, too, because in Hebrew culture, the sea is considered to be chaos. And you don't, I mean, how many Jewish sailors do we know out in the open ocean? Not many. And in this story, the disciples turn out to be pretty big wimps. Jews are afraid of water, basically. And so we have these kind of stories to show how there's power over the seas. Now, before our story starts, Jesus has been teaching the crowds for hours and hours and hours. They're tired. He's tired. He doesn't believe that he can put one more thing into their heads. I'm kind of looking out and feeling like he must have felt right now. Okay, so it's time to quit. And he told the disciples, we're out of here. We're going someplace. We're going to just chill out. We're not going to do anything. I'm not going to do any healing. I'm not going to do any nothing. I'm tired. And I want to go away. And so they got in the boat and they headed out into the sea, the northern end of the Sea of Galilee, off to the other side, to the Greek side, to the pagan side, where they knew they wouldn't get bugged too much. So before we hear our story today, and I'd like to ask Jesus, and let's see, who shall we get up here? Can I have disciple A, B, and C please come on up here and stand around this microphone right here for your parts? Thank you very much. And Jesus and the narrator, if you'd like to come stand over here right next to them and use that one mic, that would be awesome. And this is a retelling of the story by John Bell, who is a Scottish hymn writer and liturgist. In fact, he wrote The Summons, which we sing here a lot, and is going to be with us preaching in February of next year, by the way, too. So we can't have this story without the sounds of a storm, and that's your guys' part. So, are you ready? Let me hear what you guys sound like. That would not scare me. Well, use your imagination, okay? And here we go. Ready, Mark.
He was sleeping. Sleeping in the bow of the boat, the sleep of a child, the sleep of a happy child.
Jesus, did you see that wave?
He was sleeping. And nothing disturbed him. Not the wind, not the weather.
Jesus, this is getting rough.
Jesus, this is getting really rough.
Jesus, did you see that wave?
The sound of the sea, the sound of the pounding, the break of the waves, the creak of the boat.
Jesus, I'm scared.
Jesus, I'm terrified.
Jesus, I'm going to spew.
I will keep him in perfect peace, whose mind is set on me, waking or sleeping.
Jesus, can you swim?
Jesus, we're sinking.
Jesus, do something.
Wake up, Jesus, come on, help us.
Shh. Oh, where's your faith, even your little faith, in the storm? In the darkness, I am with you. Let the waves roar, but don't be distressed. Otherwise, you may never hear me saying, peace, be still.
Let's hear it for our dramatic actors. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Let's pray. Loving and gracious Spirit, we are thankful for these stories that come to us from so long ago. We are grateful that we can retell them and have fun with them and make them something that works their way into our hearts and lives. As we consider this story for our lives today, may your Spirit move, work its way within us, and may none of us leave this place unchanged. We gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. So if I were to ask you, what was the greatest best-selling book of all time, what would you say it is? What's that? Okay, how many say the dictionary? How many say the Bible? Nope, none of you got it right yet. Come on, you got to be a nerd to know this one. What's that? Oh, thank you, fellow nerd. The best-selling book in all history, if you consider the entire universe, is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Right? It is. It has, I mean, if you consider all of the sales over the entire universe, it is, bar none, far and away the best-selling book ever. According to the author of the book by the same name, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Doug Adams, it has sold far and away more than any other book. And it's got a couple reasons why. The first reason is it's cheap. That's the first reason. And the second reason why it is so popular is because emblazoned on the front cover in large friendly letters appear the words, "Don't panic." Doesn't that feel nice? Don't panic. And it's a funny thing. That alone is so reassuring to owners of the book that they carry it with them everywhere. Just as a reminder, wouldn't that be nice to have set on your desk or in your home somewhere? Every time life gets the way it often gets, you can just look at it and say, remember, don't panic. Now, it's a funny thing because that phrase, don't panic, you know where else it appears most often? In the Bible. It appears in the Bible hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. I tried to find someone that was able to count up the number of times that it appears, and I couldn't because it is so many times in the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. But what you'll see is it often appears as the phrase, do not fear or be not afraid. It's there all over the place. If you count them sometime, you will run out of steam. All through the Old Testament, it says, fear not, I am with you. At Jesus' birth, the angels have to tell the shepherds, fear not, because they're afraid. And Jesus, over and 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 over again says, don't be afraid. Fear not. You'd kind of think like that might be an issue for some of us, yes? It has to be told to us over and over again. And I wonder how different people's attitude would be towards the Bible, that instead of the very intimidating gold embossed words on the front that say, Holy Bible, if it said in nice friendly language on the front, don't panic. Wouldn't that be a better Bible? I think it would be. And it's because fear is a very powerful thing in our lives. It prompts us to seek protection in times of both real and fake danger. It motivates us into needed changes and surprising adventures. It serves as a constant reminder that we are fragile, limited, and human. It's one of the things that the advertising world depends on, is to make sure that you know that you're fragile, limited, and human, and you've got bad breath and you smell bad. Right? And that's what they make, that's what they do. They keep us in constant fear, from just the basics to our entire government, be it our government or other governments, that want to keep us in fear all the time so that we can be talked into doing all kinds of crazy things. On the other side of those impulses, we know fear also prompts us to lock our doors to the experiences in life, to the possibility of mystery, to the possibility of wonder, to the possibility of, I really don't know the answer to that, but I'm willing to entertain the possibility. It keeps us from even doing that which we are perfectly capable of doing. This morning's gospel story is about fear. And when Mark retold this story, or told this story of the stilling of the storm, it's very likely that his small community of people was either facing or recovering some direct persecution in their lives. So this would have been a story trying to encourage them. And in the face of this persecution or threats, it made sense for them to say, hey, where is the power? Let's see some action here. We want something to happen. We're afraid. And we miss the point, though, if we reduce this story to a wonder work, which leaves us basically wondering, well, where's that power to avert destructive hurricanes and storms today? Where is that power? Why don't we see it? You might remember a few years ago that Pat Robertson saw the hurricane coming towards his headquarters in, where was it, Virginia? And he got on television and prayed that the hurricane miss his office, which it did. And so he used that as proof of God's amazing power. Of course, the hurricane just moved north a little bit and wiped out a bunch of other people, which they didn't think very kindly of. But when we think that we can control things like that, I think we are missing the point of this story. I wonder how different people's attitude would be if they looked at this story just a little bit differently. You know, some people have no philosophical difficulty at all taking the story literally, and that's okay. But as with the rest of the Gospels, this serves, I think, a greater end if it is a symbolic statement. People know what it is like to be in the midst of storms. Not literally the storms of life. People know what it's like to not be in control, either with your job or with your health or with other situations in your family or what have you. And people experience situations where sometimes you get to the point where you sense that only the divine can intervene. And people still cry out, Lord, save us. Realistically, people also know that no matter how much we cry out, it's very seldom that we experience the magic of a magic wand waving and things changing just like that. Crises don't instantly resolve themselves in our lives. It often takes work. It takes grit. It takes sweat. It takes therapy, right? It takes patience. It takes strength of will. And it sometimes, after all that, does not work out the way we had hoped or planned. The question is, what are you going to do with what you've got left? With what you've got from the beginning? Have you seen that sign in some offices? It says, if you can keep your head when everyone else is losing theirs, you don't fully grasp the situation. Have you seen that? Did Jesus not fully grasp the situation in this story? Is that what's going on here? I think he was perfectly aware of the situation. He'd spent all day teaching and he was beat. He was going to get some rest. Sally? Thank you. He was on a boat. And when I'm on a boat, I can understand him being lulled to sleep right away, right? A beautiful end of the day, sunset cruise, right? And he's asleep. What could go wrong? He is on a fishing boat full of who?
Fishermen.
And where do they fish? Right there in the Sea of Galilee. How long have they done that? Their whole lives. Their whole lives. What could possibly go wrong? What's to worry about? Well, let's just rewind a little bit to the first part of chapter 4. This whole chapter leading up to this pinnacle story, Jesus is doing just one thing, and he's teaching on how to respond to Jesus' teachings. And he uses the same metaphor in many different ways. He uses the parable of the sower, right? What's that about? Throwing out the seeds, right? And it falls on different kinds of soil. The very next story, he says, is about the seed that grows secretly. The very next story he tells is the mustard seed story. So it's all of these kind of things about how receptive are you going to be to the teaching that he's offering. Are you going to hear? Are you going to understand? And guess who does not hear or understand? The disciples. They don't get it. They're typically self-congratulatory in this story. Thank you. We're with Jesus. You know, we've got the all-access pass. We're fine. Let us through. Thank you so much. right before they prove once again that they don't get it. Now, according to Rex Hunt, they had developed an unhealthy dependency on Jesus. An unhealthy dependency on Jesus. I mean, normally you might think that dependency on Jesus was a good thing. But not in this story. Walter Wink, too, chimes in and says, they awoke Jesus with reproaches. They lacked any faith in themselves. They said, you deal with the storm, Jesus. And Jesus could have said, excuse me, you guys are sailors. Give me a break. But he was already awake, and like an impatient parent who could stand over their child and make sure they do what you know very well they could do, but you could do much faster yourself, he just gets up and says, all right, peace, be still. And it's done. And he can go back to sleep. And as he goes back to sleep, he says, you guys, I mean, can't you even do what you do? Confront your fears. Forget your dependency. You have resources. Do what you do. This isn't a story for us to just sit back and say, whoa, isn't that Jesus something? It's a story challenging the hearers to not be terrified of life and to use your God-given gifts. Now, there was another gospel, the Gospel of Thomas, which did not make the cut, not very widespread, but I think it's helpful in this place. It says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. And in Greek, save means will make you whole, will make you complete, right? If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. It's even more dramatic than use it or lose it. If you don't use the thing that is within you to live out what your gifts are, then that very thing will contribute to destroying you. The real miracle is not in something spectacular happening that we can sit back and say, that was cool. Mark seems to be telling us a story where even Jesus is saying, the real miracle would be if you guys actually took some responsibility and did something that is perfectly within your power to do. Faith is not something that you have, that you possess, that you cling to. It's something that you do. It's something that you express in your life. You don't gather it. You don't save it. You don't hoard it for when you need it. It's not collecting stuff. You demonstrate it in the way you live your life. Now, John Wesley, who's the founder of our Methodist movement, for some of you Lutherans and Presbyterians lurking out there, and he was feeling not very good about who he was and his call to be a priest. He was a priest in the Church of England, but he was feeling like, you know, I really haven't done enough to get God's attention and to get God's approval, so let me do something crazy and radical that God will go, nice job, pal. So he signed up to be a missionary to the penal colony in Savannah, Georgia, in the 1730s. Let me tell you, Savannah, Georgia, not much in the 1730s. There were a lot of prisoners and John Wesley. And on his way over there, he was in a total funk. They hit the big-time storm season going across the Atlantic, and things, I mean, even the crew was nervous because this storm was so bad, and they were making preparations in case the mast broke. And Wesley went down with some of the other passengers down in the lowest part of the ship, down into the hold. And there he found some of his fellow passengers. They were Moravians from Germany, and they were a small sect of Pietists. They kind of have the kind of Pennsylvania Dutchess kind of folks. And they were down in the bottom of the hold, and there they were singing hymns and reading psalms by candlelight, and were, to all who could observe, seemed perfectly calm with the situation. And it drove Wesley crazy because he was clinging to the mast thinking, I'm going to die, I'm going to die. And here, I'm a priest. And these lay people seem to have it together. And it irritated him. All the time he was in Savannah, it was part of the problem he had in Savannah. He was a total failure there. He got literally run out of Savannah for a love affair, which that's another sermon. But when he, by the time he made it back to London, he was just a wreck of a man because he'd been confronted by these people who, in the midst of a storm, when he felt he should have been able to, you know, stand up and offer other people peace, they were the ones that were offering it to him. And it was only later that he realized that the reason that they were doing that is because that's what they do. And that's what they do best. To this day, that is one of the things that they do best. And in the midst of the storm, in the midst of strife, they did what they do best. And that helped center them so that they could get through that difficult time without running around like crazy people or strapping themselves to the mast. So it left a huge impression on Wesley. And it helps us to remember that the opposite of faith, what do you think the opposite of faith is? Doubt is what a lot of people would say. But it's really not. The opposite of faith is fear. Why are you afraid? Jesus asks. Fear paralyzes people into inaction. And faith, on the other side, is action. It's taking action. It's doing what you do, what you are gifted at doing anyway. And what Jesus is saying, don't depend on me to do what you can do for yourself. And so our stream of thought for today is don't panic. Don't be afraid. Be a person of faith, a faither. That means understanding the situation perfectly, knowing all the odds, knowing what is ahead of you, being realistic about everything, but still managing to remain calm, even in the midst of the storm. Because within us is that seed that has been planted by the sower, the promise of peace, even in the midst of a storm. There's a painting entitled The Storm on the Sea by Rembrandt. And there it is. Thankfully, we actually have a picture of it because it was stolen from the Stuart Gardner Museum in Boston a number of years ago. But this is Rembrandt's rendition of this story. And you can see there are some disciples. Jesus is in the back of the boat there near the stern, and they're coming and they're pleading with Jesus. And it's really a small vessel being struck by a large wave. And there's something strange about this painting if you actually get in there and start counting the disciples. If you count everybody on the boat, how many should there be? Jesus plus 12, 13. How many people are in this picture? 14. There are 14 pictures. 14 people pictured. And that's because right down there in the bottom right, Rembrandt painted himself in. He painted himself in because he wanted to be reminded that even in the worst storm in his life, that he was in the boat with Jesus. As the Gospel of Thomas tells us, if you do not bring forth that which is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. But if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will make you whole. So be not afraid. And whatever you do, don't panic. Amen.